Coming up on the Inside Indiana Business Television podcast, we look at a wild year for Hoosier farmers. Around Indiana shines a spotlight on another endangered landmark. This month's Trendiana segment looks at Indiana's flavors of fall. Ball State's president talks about making students more marketable. A potential game changer could be coming for college athletes. And we preview the Salvation Army's holiday campaign, as well as the annual College Goal Sunday event. Welcome to the Inside Indiana Business Television podcast. I'm Andy Ober. It's a busy time for Indiana's 94,000 farmers who are in the middle of the fall harvest season. Despite the pandemic, a recent Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer report shows farmers are bullish on what lies ahead. Indiana State Department of Agriculture Director Bruce Kettler joined Inside Indiana Business host Gary Dick with more on the state of the $31 billion industry in the state.
A roller coaster ride, to put it mildly, this year for Indiana agriculture. Give us your take on the state of agriculture and how things have progressed from a spring when there was a lot of uncertainty.
Well, I think you've characterized it very well, frankly. You know, there was some optimism coming out of the really difficult year last year. COVID-19, the pandemic hit. That certainly changed some things in agriculture in many ways. And then we had a lot of dry weather in the state of Indiana, particularly in parts of Indiana, where it was not very optimistic that some of our crops would do well, but there were some timely rains in some situations. But now in the last 3 or 4 weeks, especially, the crop prices for corn and soybeans have improved. We've had some rebound in some of the livestock prices as well. And frankly, I think overall, we've had pretty good yields out of the corn and soybeans. Again, it's been variable, and there are parts of the state that certainly are not going to be what they had hoped. But overall, I think our crops have been resilient, and with the improvement in prices, that's provide a little more optimism, I would say, going into the fall.
Yeah, we talked this week with Brent Bible. He's a farmer in Tippecanoe County, the Romney area, farms about 5,000 acres of seed corn and soybeans. And he talked about exactly that, how difficult it looked in the spring, and how things really have come back in a big way.
They have. And, you know, I think for farmers and those that are involved in the production and agriculture, we know that we're going to be at the whim of the weather, in some cases the markets, but hopefully this gives everybody a little more optimism that we're going to go into next year with some things that have improved.
Yeah, absolutely. And to get a flavor for what ag farmers were thinking, here's what Brent Bible had to say earlier in the week.
We really had painted a pretty bleak picture in the spring and really into the summer, into midsummer. We thought the crop was progressing fairly well. We were happy with conditions and that type of thing, but the price levels just weren't there, and we were having trouble seeing how that was going to lead to a break even or to a profit for the year. You just have to maintain a positive outlook that things will be good, will continue to improve, we will get better and get through the next hurdle or get over the next hurdle.
And Bruce, so it sounds like things, generally speaking, have kind of improved to the point where 2020 is not looking nearly as challenging as it once was. Also, add on top of that, the USMCA, the new trade agreement with Mexico and Canada, and what that might, offer for farmers going forward in terms of the outlook.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a really important agreement, and I think I've heard it said before, and I know I've shared with people as well. You know, you have to be able to show to the rest of the world that you can do business with your neighbors. And that's why the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement was so important from an agriculture perspective, is not only to help our crops and our livestock farmers, but being able to show them that we can work together and that we can work with our neighbors in a positive way. And I think USMCA sets us up for a lot of very positive things to happen in agriculture once we get past the pandemic and keep moving on.
And Bruce, another important development, I think, over the course of the past several months, the state using some CARES funding to help some of these meat processing operations, local processing operations around the state of Indiana that were hit very, very hard by the pandemic.
Absolutely. We have been able to get some dollars from the CARES Act that will be able to help with growth and expansion of our Indiana meat processors. We, in fact, just concluded those applications. We have 60 applications, and those will be reviewed, and we'll be able to get those out here pretty quickly. But it allows some of these meat processors to look at expansion, things like personal protective equipment if they've needed that. Maybe there's some employee training, or they need some new equipment in order to keep this going, and we want to make sure that we help with that. It's a matching grant, a max of $150,000 per business, but they have to match and put money in to make it work, and we're excited to be able to offer that.
Yeah, and a number of ag organizations and related organizations have pivoted during the pandemic. I know there's a big announcement not long ago, a major investment by POET, the big biofuels company, shifting production at a biofuels plant here to produce ingredients that goes into hand sanitizer.
That's right. About a $25 million investment to add on to that plant, which was really going to help. And it's interesting how in just a few short months, all of a sudden we're worried about ethanol coming out of our plants to go to things like hand sanitizer. Yeah. But this is good. This will bring in about it'll create a market for about $10 to $12 million bushels more corn going into that plant just to be able to feed the ethanol that they're going to use for hand sanitizer.
Yeah. You only have about 30 seconds left, Bruce, but kind of looking in the crystal ball, agriculture, the ag bioscience is such an important part of the Indiana economy. As you look ahead to 2021, cautious optimism? How would you frame it?
Yeah, I think cautious optimism is a good way to put it. What I find with people in agriculture, whether it's farmers or people that are supplying them and working in ag business, always know we've got to be optimistic. I think Brent said it very well. And there's always going to be opportunities for young people with careers and being able to participate in this. And with the changes in technology and things that are happening, I'm always optimistic that there's a place for anybody that wants to get involved in this business.
All right. Bruce Kettler is the director. The Indiana State Department of Agriculture. Bruce, as always, thanks for some great perspective. We'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure. Thanks, Gary.
In just 5 years, DemandJump has evolved from a small software-as-a-service startup to become a major player in the digital marketing space. The company recently rated as Indiana's highest-ranking business on Inc. magazine's annual list of the fastest-growing U.S. companies. Co-founder and CEO Christopher Day came on the show to share insights on his company's growth.
Coming to us from your cool offices in downtown Indianapolis, overlooking the Circle. 5 years, hard to believe it's been 5 years since you launched DemandJump. But give us a thumbnail description, if you will, of the platform and really what it's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. So at a high level, DemandJump aligns how you market and sell to how your target market decides and buys. And we do that cross-channel. So think of it as assembling the world's data. We create networks of customer behavior around any topic that's important to you. And then we rank everything in order of the most important to inform what actions to take next.
As we were talking off camera before the interview started, you feel the pandemic has really brought some things to light in the digital marketing space, including how companies align with customer behavior and how out of whack that whole process really is. What do you mean by that?
Yep, so absolutely. So COVID absolutely changed customer behavior forever and accelerated it by 10 years overnight. And what we're seeing is marketers are now 13 years behind, you know, what their customers are actually thinking and doing. And so we always like to look at third-party studies to validate that. There's a lot of them out there, but one of them is McKinsey. And they did a study in 2016 and 2019. Interviewing buyers, right? All of this applies to B2C and B2B, but this was specifically around B2B buyers that are buying, you know, products, tech, services, et cetera. And over 70% of them prefer digital interactions in the research and evaluation phase, while at the same time, less than half of B2B sales and marketing leaders thought that digital interactions were more important. And McKinsey did that study again after post-COVID. And the good thing is now that sales and marketing leaders now believe the same thing as their customers do, that those digital interactions are indeed more important. The problem is that the sales and marketing team leaders cannot see real customer behavior beyond their four walls today.
Mm-hmm. Mentioned some of the accolades DemandJump has been receiving. You've grown to 20 employees, raised about $6 million, I think it was last year as well. As you look, what's next? What's next for DemandJump? Where do you see your future and future growth opportunities?
Yep, so we're really excited about a couple of things. Number one, as we rolled out PLG, a product-led growth piece of our platform. So we used to only sell enterprise platform to enterprise players, which we still have customers today that are enterprise players. But now you can come in and start getting value out of our platform for customer behavior for as little as $99. And we have customers that are paying $99 all the way up to well into the six figures for the full breadth of the platform. So we're really excited about rolling that out. And then we're also working with a couple of strategic partners to embed part of our platform into their partner networks.
I only have 30 seconds, Toph, but growing the company in what has become really a SaaS, a digital marketing hotbed in Indianapolis, is that an advantage to be here?
You know, I really do. I think so. And as we've talked in the past over the last few years, Gary, I like to think of Indiana and Indianapolis as the nation's nucleus. And I think it takes seven ingredients for that to happen as a part of the productivity boom. And it all starts with infrastructure. Then you're looking at talent, you're looking at mission-critical industries, tech, cost of living, lifestyle, and regulatory environment. It takes all those pieces and parts to have a robust ecosystem. And I think we were recently just ranked number one best place to start a tech company. And it's also easy to get to anyone you know, that you need to get to know to help grow your business in this environment.
All right, Christopher Day, congratulations on 5 years at DemandJump. We look forward to continuing to follow the story, Toph. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Gary.
If you're looking for your dream home and a chance to preserve an Indiana gem, you might find what you're looking for at 507 North Walnut Street in Batesville. Built in 1911, the Rahm Weber House is a 6,000-square-foot architectural stunner. Around Indiana reporter Mary Rachel Redmond takes us to Ripley County to check out the house and learn what's in the works to save it.
For nearly a century and a half, Batesville was home to one of the top furniture makers in America.
The Rahm Weber furniture, just because it was all handmade, solid wood construction, very well known within the United States.
Rahm Weber Furniture has graced the homes of former presidents, various Saudi royal families, and even notorious mafia dons.
The company was very flourishing, had a lot of salesmen that went out and just brought a lot of work back to our little carvers here in Batesville.
The Rahm Webers are the reasons why Batesville is really on the map. You see their furniture and it's like no other. It's got these great sort of over-dramatic vines or Viking touches. People came here for the furniture, came here for the Rahm Weber name.
Which makes this home, built in 1911 by the founder of the Rahm Weber Furniture Company, a treasured piece of Batesville's past that unfortunately has fallen into disrepair.
It's a little bit of several different early 20th century styles all wrapped into one. And that's why it was so important to be on our list, not only because of its importance to Batesville history, but as an architectural piece here, it's so unique.
And by all accounts, Anthony Rahm Weber set out to make his Batesville home a major statement. And that it did. So much so, over 100 years later, it caught the eye of a buyer in Indianapolis just this last September who plans to use the original blueprints to completely refurbish the home to its original glory.
It caught someone's eye, like we hoped, by again casting that net really wide for our preservation-minded audience. It's unbelievable that it happened so quickly, but again, right place, right time, and putting the opportunity out there is what made it happen. So I'm so thankful that it was listed, and I'm so thankful for the new owner who wants to come in and turn the clock back and bring back all the character that it has.
Anthony's home, the workmanship, the detail, just the beauty of it, that is all a part of our history. And you learn from your history, and you need to save your history for future generations.
Mary Rachel Redmond, Inside Indiana Business.
Whether it's a trip to the County Line Orchard in Hobart, Oliver Winery in Bloomington, or a cruise along the Apple Trail in Fort Wayne, there's still plenty of time to experience the best of fall in Indiana. It's also a great opportunity to support local businesses. In this month's Trendiana segment, Yelp Senior Regional Lead of Community and Marketing, Brittany Smith, details the state's flavors of fall.
you know, fall is that perfect time for folks to get out and around the state. And I know you're seeing that, especially this year with the pandemic, there's really seems to be a surge in interest in folks just doing that around Indiana.
Definitely. Our data science team has really seen a surge in pumpkin patch searches, apple orchards, folks wanting to find ways to still have activities, but in safe settings. So those are some common areas that we've seen a lot of traffic lately.
And again, support Indiana businesses at the same time. So let's take a spin around the state. You've assembled some great locations. One, we're talking about fall alcoholic beverages, a great spot, Oliver Winery.
Yes, it is the season of apple pie wine. Actually, it's one of their seasonal wines that come out at Oliver Winery. They've got it out right now. And when you talk about a business that's very friendly for getting out and having a lot of space for social distancing, their property with all the acreage, picnic tables, they've really got it set up in a way that you can really enjoy fall. They've got pumpkins throughout the property, really beautifully decorated. It's a really fun spot this time of year.
When you kind of transition then to the fall baked goods, lots of locations around the state of Indiana, including Rosie's Place, that's here in central Indiana, several spots, right? Zionsville, Carmel, and Noblesville.
Yeah, and Rosie's is celebrating 10 years actually this year, a staple in central Indiana. They're really known for their gooey butters, if you've never had that. And right now they've got a spin on it with a caramel apple version and a pumpkin version. And they've also got a new apple whiskey cake with the cinnamon cream cheese frosting that I'm really excited to try myself. A really fun fall baked good menu.
All right, we go to Northeast Indiana. Fall and apples really go hand in hand. Having worked many years ago in Fort Wayne, I know it's home to the Johnny Appleseed, and Johnny Appleseed used to have the festival there, but the Apple Trail, right, in Fort Wayne.
Yeah, this is a great way if you're looking for a weekend adventure, just to mix up your scenery. They're full of apple orchards, like you said, learning about Johnny Appleseed and this heritage. Some fun stops there are Ambrosia Orchard, which actually has a hard cider flight that you can try out. There's also that caramel apple latte and some really fun fall beverages at Firefly Coffee House. And then another classic this time of year is the apple pie baked beans at Shigs and Pitt. That's a really fun stop there in the Fort Wayne area, too.
Yeah, good stuff going on in Northeast Indiana. Staying on the drink theme, looking at fall cocktails, Cicero is home to 10 West. Been there several times, a great restaurant and also a great place for a fall cocktail.
Yeah, folks describe this as kind of a surprisingly upscale restaurant in a really quaint lake town of Cicero, if you're not familiar. And the caramel vodka, actually, it's caramel apple martini, but it's got caramel vodka, fresh local apple cider, and butterscotch. Really delicious way to say cheers to the fall. Really fun dish there at the 10 West.
Okay, I'm writing that one down. Okay, our last stop is Northwest Indiana. This is a real sleeper because there's County Line Orchard in Hobart. That is really a massive, as the pictures indicate, location there. It's getting some national attention, too.
Definitely. It is a destination orchard. It actually made our data list of the top apple orchard in the state for 2020. And as a result, it's been picked up in a lot of media outlets throughout the country this year. County Line Orchard, folks love to go there for the hot apple cider, classics like the apple cinnamon donuts. It's really where you can get one of those quintessential fall experiences. Really fun to pick your own apples and pumpkins.
All right. Brittany Smith from Yelp. Once again, a great tour around the state of Indiana for the flavors of fall. And again, supporting Hoosier businesses as well. Thanks for joining us. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Likewise. Thanks, Gary.
Remember, you can catch Inside Indiana Business Television on stations throughout the state every weekend. Head to InsideIndianaBusiness.com to check listings. Ball State University is making big strides in developing its students to be attractive as possible to potential employers. Graduation rates have increased, and the university is putting a stronger emphasis on lifetime learning and expanding its presence in Indianapolis. Ball State President Jeffrey Mearns joined us with details.
Before we get to some of those issues, as I understand it, you had a couple of special guests on campus this week, some rather high-profile celebrities.
We did. David Letterman, one of our most famous graduates, came to campus with Peyton Manning to film an episode of Peyton's show called Peyton's Places. And as you may know, he travels around the country, different locations. And we were delighted that Dave brought Peyton to campus. It was a great opportunity for our football players and our students. It was a fun day. And we look forward to the program because it help promote the university and our campus and the city of Muncie.
Great opportunity for the university. I look forward to watching that. I know it'll be a great show. Mentioned some of the key points coming in, President Mearns, but so much attention on Indiana's great academic institutions of higher education, their connection to community, connection to the state. As you look at some of the things going on that you're really spearheading there at Ball State to make more of a connection, one with the graduation rates. I looked at the numbers there, and over the past 10 to 14 years, I guess, those graduation rates, four-year numbers, have increased in a big way.
Yeah, so we're grateful to our faculty and staff who are committed to the personal success of all of our students. And we've really tried to engage more students from all across the state of Indiana to come to our campus. You know, every year the freshman class is usually about 80 to 85% Hoosiers. This year, notwithstanding the pandemic, nearly 90% of the incoming freshman class were Indiana residents. And as you know, Gary, we engage our students with the community while they're here. We engage them with employers across the state. And as a result, many of our students, after they graduate, stay in Indiana. We think we estimate that we have more than 120,000 Ball State graduates who are living and working here in Indiana. We're proud of that commitment. We see ourselves as Indiana's public research university.
And you're really doubling down on that, trying to get more Indiana students at Ball State. How are you going to do that? What are some of the ways or initiatives you're really going to focus on getting more Indiana students on the Muncie campus?
So we've spread our connections to guidance counselors and engaging guidance counselors in sharing the good things that are happening on our campus, what we think is the distinctive educational experience here at Ball State. We also have wonderful facilities. We're fortunate that the state of Indiana has continued to invest in our campus. We have two new academic buildings under construction, two new residence halls. But we think it's the distinctive relationship that our faculty and staff have with our students, that personal educational connection. And through immersive learning experiences, enables our students while they're here, while they're getting their education, to see how they can apply what they're learning in the classroom or in a laboratory to real-world problems, real-world settings. And so we think that's very attractive to our students and makes them really capable of serving employers and serving our communities after they graduate.
And that focus on community, too. I know, I think, that not long after you entered the president's office, we talked about the need for Ball State to connect with East Central Indiana as well as the rest of the state. Talk about efforts, and I know one that is just in the very formative stages now, but this talent collaborative that you're being talked about there in a 10-county area, you know, talent's such a big issue for the state of Indiana.
That's right. So first of all, it begins at home, and we're engaged in revitalizing here the city of Muncie. Our future at the university is linked to the future of our city, but we see that what we're doing right here in Muncie and in Delaware County, we can expand that through the East Central region. So we're in the early stages of reaching out to educational partners, to businesses, to economic development organizations. We want to create a cradle-to-career talent collaborative throughout East Central Indiana. We can't do it alone, but we do believe that we can help convene that kind of a collaborative, and we're looking forward to engaging our partners.
Looking ahead, President Mearns, at the post-pandemic Ball State, if you will, I think education, I think all areas of the economy are certainly changing. As you look at that post-pandemic model for education, any differences you see going forward, or what's your vision for the university once things get back to some sense of normalcy?
Well, so you mentioned earlier about our commitment to lifelong learning, and mm-hmm. we see as the pandemic has accelerated some of the changes that we have seen happening in the workplace. The notion that that workers need to and employers need to upskill and reskill their workers, and we want to be a part of that process. So as part of one of our integral goals in our new strategic plan is to do more in terms of lifelong learning. And that means not just online learning, it means on-demand learning. We're expanding educational opportunities and locations in the Indianapolis area. They might be not degrees, but they might be other kind of alternative credentials, stackable credentials. We're going to take a more innovative and flexible approach, breaking away from that notion that everything has to lead to a formal degree and everything has to be done on campus in a 14 to 16 week semester. Much more flexible, much more adaptive, much more accessible to learners of all ages and all interests.
Very interesting perspective from Ball State University President Jeffrey Murns. President Murns, it's always great to see you. Thanks for joining us. Look forward to visiting you on campus, hopefully sooner rather than later.
We'd love to have you here, Gary. Thank you very much for your time.
A potential game changer could be around the corner for college athletes, as the NCAA has introduced a plan that would allow them to sell their own signatures, endorse certain products, and take advantage of their name, image, and likeness. The NCAA will vote on the proposal in January. Sporting News senior writer and Big Ten network analyst Mike DeCourcy joined Bill Benner on Inside Indiana Sports.
Let's start off just by giving us, as best you can, a capsule overview of NIL and what this potentially means.
Well, what it entails is basically two separate elements. One is the student-athlete-run business. Especially with the advent of social media, we have seen athletes who have been able to create YouTube businesses, other social media, Instagram-type businesses, and have occasionally run afoul of NCAA regulators with that. And the NCAA in the new legislation will basically say, that's fine, we're good with that, go ahead and do it. And then the second element is the one that seems the most obvious and common, which would be endorsements. And that's where it's a little bit more complicated in order to regulate, because there are inevitably going to be clashes, conflicts between the student athlete's desire to endorse a particular product and products that already have an exclusive arrangement with the university where they attend. That's problematic. And then, of course, there's the booster element. And What involvement can the booster have in inviting athletes from the sports and teams that they love to endorse their products or endorse their or do appearances at their venues, that sort of thing? So those are the two elements where athletes are going to be able to make money. We know that for certain athletes, that's going to be a lot of money. We don't know exactly how widespread it's going to be, but I think it's going to have a really strong impact on how college sports operate.
And Mike, we mentioned again some states, and I believe California was at least one of those, were embarking on passing their own legislation that really is kind of forcing the NCAA's hand on this entire initiative.
Yeah, what Florida and California in particular, and there's a few others, what they've really done is sped the process. They have forced the NCAA. I think that we were going down this direction anyway over the last half dozen years or so, with various activists pushing for it, with various court cases that leading them in that direction, and then with the state legislations of California and Florida in particular, they've forced the NCAA to say, okay, let's get this going. But they also have the issue now that they're putting forth a body of regulations. They really need the federal government, the NCAA does. They really need the federal government to adopt what the NCAA is doing to some extent so that they can do two things. One, supersede the state regulations. You can't have Florida with different rules than California and Indiana and Texas, et cetera, when they're all trying to play the same sports, so to speak. And then the other is the idea that the NCAA doesn't want to be sued because their regulations aren't generous enough or that they restrict a particular area or whatever. So if the federal government were to legislate, then at that point, they wouldn't have to worry about getting sued either in the future or from past actors.
Mike, we think about Division I men's basketball and football, the revenue-producing sports. But for Olympic athletes, this could really be beneficial for them.
Yeah, especially Olympic-level athletes, not just those who are in what's classified as Olympic sports, because they don't want to call them non-revenue sports. But for those who are at that level, like a Lily King, like a Katie Ledecky, players and athletes who are extraordinary in those sports, will be able to do very well. And Katie Ledecky, and I'm sure Lily as well, I think Katie made like $355,000 in gold medal bonuses from the Olympic Committee, and she was allowed to keep that. And I would imagine that Lily probably did well there too. She was so good in 2016. I think those athletes will do really well. The question is, will any of this get down to those who are not at the elite level?
Mike, we have to wrap up. This goes before the entire NCAA at its convention in January. I assume that there's no doubt that it will be passed at least in some form.
Yes, no doubt it'll be passed in some form. I think they're still going to wrestle a little bit. This is what they call the comment period. So any suggestions that anyone has from the membership to tweak it, now's the time. And then they'll vote on it in January, and it'll be approved. And then they're hoping that the federal government can jump on this maybe in the spring, so that when Florida comes, their legislation comes online in July, they'd like to have it, I think, a new federal law that would supersede that by then.
Well, Mike DeCorsi, the Sporting News and the Big Ten Network, we certainly appreciate you taking the time to join us today. By the way, follow this guy on Twitter. He's really a good read and a very, very long-time expert in the world of college sports. Mike, thanks for being on with us.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanksgiving is a few weeks away, with Christmas following soon after. The holidays will look much different this year due to the pandemic, especially for underserved communities. For the first time in its 130-year history, the Salvation Army is starting its annual Red Kettle campaign 2 months early. Indiana Divisional Commander Major Mark Johnson discusses what the Salvation Army is doing to meet the need with Kylie Valletta in the Business of Health.
All right, just a quick refresher. The Salvation Army puts food on the table, pays bills, provides shelter, and puts gifts under the tree for thousands of Hoosiers every Christmas season. You've seen an increase in demand in your services ever since the pandemic started. So tell us about that increase and what you think that might mean for the Christmas season as well this year.
Well, when many people were staying at home to be safe from the pandemic starting in March, the Salvation Army was not. We were out meeting needs and meeting an increased demand for needs. We packed food boxes. We did blessing bags. We provided emotional and spiritual care to people who were suffering from that isolation and trying to work through what does this mean and how do I go on with my life in a meaningful way. So the Salvation Army's been there and we work 365 days a year wherever the need is. And at Christmas time, we're anticipating that the need is going to grow because there are more and more people who are out of work.
All right, so the bell ringers are such a symbolic part of Christmas. Will there be fewer bell ringers this year? And how will they look different this season 2020?
Well, there may be fewer bell ringers, but we are encouraged in that several of our major retail department stores who partner with us regularly have already approved our agreement. We are taking precautions for our volunteers and our other bell ringers to make sure that they are safe from transmitting COVID or even catching it. And so they will have a video before they go out to make sure that they will learn the new rules, if you will. And the kettles will be out, but they may not be out as in force as in past years.
Yeah, we talked about some of the unique challenges just with stores, some closing, a lot of people carrying less cash and coins. So one strategy the Salvation Army is taking is kind of making the kettles more high tech this year. So explain how the kettles are sort of being modernized this year.
Well, on every Red Kettle stand, there's a sign up at the top. And on that sign, every one of them will have a QR code, which is that little square with a bunch of black dots in it that you can scan. And on your smartphone, it'll take you straight to a donation page. And it is high tech enough to know that whichever location you are donating and scanning at is the location where those funds are going to go. So I can tell you that all funds that are given locally stay local.
Yes, so important to know that it stays right there in the community. As you know, we have a business audience for our show. Is there a message you'd like to share with businesses or potential corporate partners out there?
Yeah, the first thing I want to say is thank you. We have a long history of good relationships with many businesses, but there are many businesses who've never really decided to reach out and consider how they could contribute at this time of year. So I want to encourage people to let them know we need more relationships. We are open to work with you. There's so many different ways that that can happen. One of the ways that is also tied in with that high tech is that you as a business owner or as a corporation can do a virtual online Red Kettle. Now, that's not live yet. It's coming November 1st. So hang on, get ready. But it will be coming. And that's a great way to raise money peer-to-peer. You can send out links to people and they can donate. You can raise directly for the Salvation Army on a virtual Red Kettle. So it's not so cold as you know, standing out ringing a bell.
All right. We've talked a lot about the challenges you're facing. We were talking off camera. Despite those challenges, you say you are hopeful. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I am a man of faith, and the Salvation Army is a faith-based organization. Part of our mission statement says that we preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and meet human needs in his name without discrimination. And one of the greatest messages that we have for people is that there's hope. You are not alone. God's word tells us that God does not abandon us. He understands. He's with us. And we believe that he's going to provide, and, you know, he does that through our hard work, and we trust in him. So we're grateful for everyone who partners with us, and we want to bring that hope to everyone at Christmas and throughout the year.
All right. Well, I know the Salvation Army tracks giving throughout the season, so good luck as this campaign is getting underway very soon. We really hope that Hoosier Generosity will step up to the plate.
They've done great so far, and I thank you for this opportunity.
Absolutely. Major Johnson, thanks for being on the show.
And finally this week, for the past 32 years, more than 98,000 students and families have used College Goal Sunday as an essential tool in helping them get financial aid to pay for higher education. The free program helps students fill out their student aid forms properly and on time. We get details on this year's virtual event from College Goal Sunday co-chair Bill Wozniak.
I think most people have heard of College Goal Sunday, been around for a long time, again, more than three decades. But give us that thumbnail description, Bill, of what College Goal Sunday is all about.
College Goal Sunday was created to help all families file the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, which is the most important financial aid form. If you are going to be attending college or getting higher education in the next year, this is the form that needs to be filed, and College Goal Sunday was created to help people get that form filed.
The FAFSA process can be a daunting task, and it's interesting that 32 years now for College Goal Sunday, 90,000 plus, maybe 100,000 families impacted. This has actually become a model, right, that other states have copied.
Absolutely. It started right here in Indiana. We're so pleased about that. And then it spread across the country, and it's taken slightly different forms in different states. But it started here. It moved across the country because people all over the country need help filing the FAFSA.
Well, let's talk about this year's event. Like many others, very different. 100 or so volunteers involved in what will be the first ever virtual College Goal Sunday.
That's right. Because of things going on, of course, we had to make it a virtual event. We've always enjoyed and look forward in the future to having our local in-person events. But over the last few months, we had to get this set up. The families need the help. And so we moved to a virtual event where families will be able to get that help from the comfort of their own home and be able to get the help from those experts that you spoke about and get that FAFSA filed virtually.
Yeah, interesting, Bill. The pandemic has affected so many things, obviously. And while the impact of College Goal Sunday has always been there, perhaps its potential impact this year is even greater because of the students and how they've been impacted by the pandemic.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. You have students that were juniors last year in the spring, March, April, May, and there's so often events that help them get ready for senior year and all they have to get done. A lot of those events were canceled. Now these students are seniors, and as we know, different school districts are disrupted in different ways. So in some ways, they're missing out on that help now at the beginning of senior year, so they're doubly impacted. Mm-hmm. And so something like College Goal Sunday helps that family in a virtual way get that FAFSA filed, and the experts will be there, so the students that might be impacted in the way we just described will be able to ask the experts the questions that they need answers for.
Okay, let us know what families need to do to connect. Again, this is the first virtual event. Our show airs at varying times around the state of Indiana, but Sunday afternoon at 2 is when it all happens. How do folks connect?
Sunday at 2 Eastern Time, families can get the help. All they have to do is go to collegegoalsunday.org, go to the website. There will be a link there, and click on that link, and they will enter the platform. And there will be over 100 volunteers, as you mentioned, waiting to help them. And on the College Goal Sunday website is a list of things to have handy that will help you during College Goal Sunday to get the FAFSA filed.
All right. It is an event invented essentially in Indiana, College Goal Sunday. You go to collegegoalsunday.org, 2 p.m. Sunday Eastern Time. Bill Wozniak, thanks very much. Thanks for all you do in the education world, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Gary.
That wraps up this week's Inside Indiana Business television podcast. Remember, you can find all of this week's TV segments, as well as the top business news from throughout the state, at InsideIndianaBusiness.com. While you're there, you can also subscribe to our platform of free e-newsletters. This is Andy Ober for Inside Indiana Business.